This is Tractor Tuesday Live, hosted by sixth generation Nebraska farmer and Tractor Tuesday founder Zach Bosley and Scott Anderson, owner of New Age Ag Supply. Join them each week as they sit down with farmers, innovators, dealers, and creators who are enhancing the culture within agriculture, right here on Tractor Tuesday Live.
Hey, Zach Bosley. I'm here live, as usual, with Scott Anderson, New Age Ag Supply. Today, I think it might be a first for us, but we've got an active, actual farmer. You know, we've had so many other guests on the show from different, parallel spaces within ag, and it's going to be kind of a fun one today. But if you haven't done this yet, please like, subscribe, do all those things. Make sure to hit the notifications icon so you can get these alerts. And I say it every week and every time we're live. I have no idea when we're going live next, so it wouldn't hurt to get a notification. But on today's show here at Tractor Tuesday Live, we've got Todd Goldsmith. Todd, how you doing, and how's the weather out there today?
Great. Nice weather, and enjoying it.
And yeah, it looks sunny. And what part of Iowa are you from?
We are about 60, 70 miles east of Omaha, Nebraska,
in the
corner of Iowa, little town of Corning.
I'm familiar. I used to go about 100 miles east into Iowa, actually exit 100, going to Redfield there. It's you see all those beautiful, you know, hilly terraced farms right by the interstate, and I've got some good friends, so when I say this, don't be mad at me, but you know, outside of our corn being better in Nebraska, you know, the main thing is in Iowa, you guys are really phenomenally gifted at mowing ditches, so I'll give you your credit there, Todd.
I'll agree with that.
Yeah. Well, don't let you guys know you just agreed with our corn being better too. So yeah, you might want to take that one back. But no, and I know you're friends with the Andersons, and it seems like that's a common theme on our show. I don't know anybody, but Scott seems to know a lot. So we'll just go with that. But
he knows a lot of folks.
Yeah, apparently so, and it's a good thing. I'm glad he knows me. But for anybody paying attention in the audience, if you don't mind, just to give yourself a brief introduction to our audience. Our live numbers aren't necessarily great, but our replays are usually pretty strong. And if you don't mind, just start with who you are, where you're from, and I guess what you might know today.
Todd Goldsmith, like I said, from Corning, Iowa. We have a family farm there. My son and son-in-law are also involved now. We have about 7,500 acres or so, all row crop, corn and beans, no irrigation. We're dry land. We kind of started from scratch, the wife and I. In the 80s, the 18% interest took my parents down about the year I graduated out of high school. So it's all I ever knew, and got married to my wife, and she's like, you really think you want to do this again? And I said, well, that's all I know. So we kind of started from scratch and went to FHA for the first loan and kind of worked our way through it and kind of got to where we are now. And it's been a lot of ups and downs, but yeah, it's kind of how it worked.
So what year was that approximately when you got your first FHA loan?
I'm going to say probably 85, 86, somewhere in there.
Yeah. Well, at least you probably bought it right. You know, it was probably relatively cheap, because I don't know the full timeline exactly. You know, my dad just turned 70. So a lot of what I hear is just, you know, plus or minus 2 to 3 years of what's even accurate on, what I can remember. But I know, a lot of truth there. But in our area, land was probably north of 3,000 an acre. And then all of a sudden it wasn't.
Right.
And that's what happened really quick. And
that's kind of what caught my dad. He bought some, he bought about 500 acres there. I'm going to say in 81 probably. And within a year, things were going south pretty hard. And the interest was 18, 19%. And I just remember that being pretty rough times.
Was it the interest that kind of broke the camel's back on that?
Yeah.
Couldn't possibly make the interest payments with commodities?
Nope. And the commodities were just in the tank too, and just, I don't know. What's kind of scary, we don't have the interest rates like we had then, but it's a little scary right now, just in the times that I kind of recall back then versus now. So hopefully it doesn't get that way, but it's kind of how some of these things started out back then, as I recall.
Yeah.
Was your dad just row crops, or did he have hogs, or?
Just strictly row crops. And he, I think he got up to right around 5,000 acres at that time. And he was in his, would have been in his 40s probably. Mm-hmm. So yeah. Jeez. Anyway.
What did he do after he, did he file Chapter 11 restructuring and then they sold the land?
Yep. Yep. He did. And it drug out for, I don't know, probably 3 years. You know, at the time I recall some of the banks were actually, he was not in too bad a shape. He had quite a few farms paid for, but, and I think that was somewhat can be some of the problem with some of those guys back then too. If they had equity, those banks went after those guys that had some equity to try to cover themselves a little bit, you know, and I even had bankers back at that time kind of tell me that that was, that was the way they were going. So, you know, yeah, it's interesting times. Hope we don't see that again.
Yeah.
What did your dad end up doing after he got through that period?
They sold everything out, and it caused a divorce between my mom and dad too, the whole deal before it was done. And he actually moved to Colorado, and he lived out there till he passed away about 7 years ago, I guess now, but he lived in the Greeley area actually for all the rest of those years.
Yeah,
my aunt lived in Loveland, so we're really familiar with that area.
Yep.
What did he do for work?
He actually got into this porcelain business that he redid antique bathtubs for people, resprayed them and put the fancy fixtures on them and stuff. And that's kind of what he did. So,
yeah. Talented dude. And it's just, you know, it's a tough thing, you know, and I'm nervous about it as well, because, you know, you saw the big spike and everything going on in precious metals. And I know that was kind of a theme that's repeating from the early 80s.
Right.
And I guess I haven't been paying attention to the markets this week. If there was any recovery at all in precious metals, I'd have no idea. But I think it could be the next thing that comes, you know, and if interest rates go back up, I don't think we're going to see that in this administration. And I should probably preface all this by, I don't know anything. And I'm glad to announce that this is not financial advice.
Right.
Don't talk to me about anything. Look at my bank account and run, because you'll learn really quick. You don't want to take any advice from this guy, but you know, it could be the next thing that happens, maybe under the next administration or the next, you know, chair of the Fed, who knows, you know, what's in store. And I think it's always something on the back of folks' mind that actually lived through it. You know, from your first purchase, first FHA loan, how quick did you start to feel a little bit of confidence again to, you know, basically expand the operation?
Well, my wife always had a full-time job. What was funny is we'd have neighbors. We'd start harvesting a lot of times in, I don't know, middle of September. Stuff was wet still and this and that. And my neighbors go, wow, you're aggressive. You're getting with the program. And I'd say, hey, no. My bank account says zero. I need to get some more than the bin.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So that's, but I would say, you know, 5 or 6 years into it, we was feeling pretty confident about things, and things were growing fairly fast.
Did you work for Dad before you started farming then, or what?
Yeah, I did. And then when he ended up filing bankruptcy, then I went to school at Iowa State for a couple of years too, in there after, right at the end, and always wanted to farm. So like I say, came back, talked to a neighbor friend of mine that he was a very successful guy and always had been a family friend, and kind of got some advice from him, and he'd been really successful and scraped through the 80s really hard. I mean, he'd offered actually at one time to buy a farm for me when I didn't have the money to do it. And it came up and I went to him and he's like, he says, it's tight enough for me right now. He says, I'm sorry, I can't do that either. And, but he gave me some great advice and kind of followed in his footsteps. And he was a heck of a corn grower and it paid off, I guess. So
did you start out by buying a little bit of farmland and then did you use your dad's old machinery, or how'd you kind of get the crop in?
I had a few early on. I had a few pieces of his that we started out with, like a corn planter. The tractors were all gone. Basically a corn planter he had. I guess it was an old 16 row Kinsey. I used that for a couple of years till we got kind of rolling to where we could buy our own stuff, I guess. I'm going to say it was probably 7 years before we bought the first piece of ground, I think, somewhere in that range. Paid $1,000 for it then. And at that time, thought it was still too much. That's how it is. It doesn't matter. What's funny, we just before we came down to the desert, the 20th of November, went to a farm auction. It was a farm that was really close to me there. We kind of wanted it. 112 acres, just to give you, for instance. It brought, we run it to 13. It brought 13.8, I believe. Big changes. And it's a mile down the road from this farm. In 1993, I paid $1,000 for.
Wow. Yeah. And there was a couple quick stints there in the early 90s where, and I know 93, if I remember right, we were going to Worlds of Fun. And when you're from Nebraska, that's like the dream vacation. I mean, you're going to the city. Right. So, and I think it was 93. Was that when the big flood was?
Yes.
And it felt like water world out there. It was insane, all the crop ground that was underwater. And I don't remember because I was old enough, I should know better, but was there a surge that year because of the flood? Commodity prices?
Yeah, there was, except most of our local corn at the time went to Atchison or St. Joe. I took most of mine to Atchison. I can remember at the time, if I could make a quarter a bushel on it, hauling it down there, I'd haul two loads a day.
Okay.
And leave it all hours of the night and get home all hours of the night. It's funny you say, bring up that flood, because I went down with a group of guys. There was some local guys there, like I say, that we all hauled together. We was some of the last trucks that went through the bottom across from St. Joe to Atchison because they closed the road. I can remember driving across and all you could see was water, and there was cops, patrolmen in the road kind of telling you where you needed to be. And as soon as we got through there, they closed it down and we had to come back a different way the next morning when we got dumped. So that thing was devastating down through there. You couldn't believe how it looked.
it was really, it's something that's still in my memory, and it might've even been my first vacation, with the, going to Worlds and Oceans of Fun. It was right there. It was the whole dang I-29 corridor. It was just underwater. But I do remember we were farrowing sows and had a ton of hogs. And even in my part of kind of southeast central Nebraska, we had, tons of rain. I don't think my dad could go because it was, every bit of keeping the troughs dry and anything we could, at the time. But there seems like there was a little bit of a couple positives. Positive years there in the early 90s, at least.
Definitely. So
you started just renting a few quarters or so back in the day. Was it easy to rent land back then? Because there was a lot of guys that didn't want to expand at that point, or how was that?
I'd say it was fairly easy. I had a lot of people come to me. And what's funny, I still have some of them farms today that I had back then. I've got some guys I've farmed for 25 years, probably easily. And two, in fact. So you know, it kind of, I just tried to treat people right and do things the right way, I guess. And I think it's paid off. So, but yeah, it was, I would say it was fairly easy because it was, things were kind of in a downturn there and guys were, going the other way. So it made it somewhat easier. Now over the years, it's definitely gotten harder. Like my son, getting him involved and stuff, it's been it's been tougher to get a hold of farm ground than it used to be, for sure.
Yeah. Well, how many acres were you farming then in the early to mid 90s, roughly?
Probably, I'm going to say we was pretty quickly up to probably 1800, 2200, somewhere in there.
Now, did you have to hoe everything or cultivate every acre?
Well, that's, you know, I kind of, I've been no-tilling for a lot of years now. That was, I was kind of in the beginning of all that stuff. So we kind of adapted that early on, and, the technology has since, you know, things have changed so much in the past few years, the past 10 years, I guess, that, you know, these precision planting and all that stuff is so much better than it used to be. You know, the stubble just used to be quite an issue to deal with back in the days when you first started.
Yeah.
Trying to get some kind of wipers to push everything out of the way and get a decent stand. And now things just, you know, everything's so, so much nicer to deal with. And my son and son-in-law are so, they're pretty much up on the tech stuff. So they've made that part of it easy for me too. So
yeah.
But
God, I mean, you know, really even 1800 acres, I mean, it seems like it's kind of a daunting task with 90s technology. You know, I mean, really, if you didn't have multiple combines just kind of set for one crop or the other, it, you know, were you picking eight rows or what was
the at that time? Yeah, I guess we was probably still on eight rows. We tried to run one machine in corn because I just didn't have enough semis at the time to really keep away from it all, even though the yields weren't, I don't know, half what they are now.
Yeah.
But, you know, and then we'd run two in the soybeans for sure all the time. And it seemed like it was easier to get help back then too than it has been in the past. So that part was a lot easier, I think, at back in those days.
Yeah, it really does feel like a common theme, you know, and it's just now, it's just, gosh, I don't even know how we get so lucky. You basically have to marry your help.
Yes.
And, I think that's the secret to farming. You know, you get the in-laws involved.
That's why I've got the fifth kid coming down.
Yeah, well, there you go. And it's,
you're going to have to your own help. Yeah, Scott.
that's a scary thing, though. You're going to have to farm 100,000 acres to make a pencil to have five heads, you know, and families, you know. And it's just, that's the biggest problem with farming. It's unfortunate because in Nebraska, I know for a fact, our number one export is our quality and talent of people. You know, and these rural towns just keep getting smaller because it's unfortunate. I wish everybody could be a part of agriculture and farm 300 to 500 acres. But, you know, I mean, if you farm as little as I do, I mean, you're lucky to even get a banker to pick up the phone call, you know. And it's just, so that's the hardest part about ag. You basically have to, you know, grow. If you're not growing, in theory, you know, I guess it could be said you're dying. And so it's just kind of a delicate dance. But I guess, what was the next big jump? You're around 1800 acres. You got a few units running on the harvesters. You know, when did you really start to expand and scale?
Probably in the mid 90s, still a little later into that mode, I guess. I'm looking at my wife a little bit here and seeing if she's got any ideas too on that. But I'm going to say in that range. I had one of the guys I'm talking about that I still farm for today. He came to me. He'd known my dad, I guess, my parents, for a lot of years. And he came to me and they was ready to retire. And they had about 2,000 acres out there at the time. Wow. And I was like, wow, I don't know if I can double my, you know, double what we're doing in one season here. That's going to be a lot. Mm-hmm. So actually, at the time, I gave up a couple of farms that were real close to the center of my operation, which I hate that now because I know once you give them up, you don't, you know,
you never get them back. Yeah,
get them back. Mm-hmm. And they were a mile from my main operation now, but I gave up about, I'm going to say 500 acres at that in that year to take mm-hmm. on that 2000. So that was probably putting us around 35 to 38, 4,000, I don't know, somewhere in that range. Mm-hmm. And pretty much stayed there for quite a few years then on okay. that kind of that number. And then when my son came in, I'm going to say he came in 7 to 10 years ago, probably.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
No, she thinks it might be a little longer than that. But anyway,
15.
He came in and then we looked for some more and I brought him in. He owns some machinery type situation. Cause I wanted to get him some equity and get him rolling pretty quickly. So he's got a couple of tractors. He owns our air seeder, I guess, half of one of the planters. And then he's roughly got right around 2,000 acres, I think, somewhere in that range now. So,
yeah. I mean, pretty healthy operation. So you guys are using air seeders in for beans?
We've got two 24-row planters. Mm-hmm. One of them is 30-inch. The other one is a 15-inch splitter.
Yep.
So we usually plant most all the corn. The last couple of days of corn that's left, he'll pull off with the splitter planter and go change it over to beans. Mm-hmm. And the air seeder's been running since the day we started planting corn.
Oh, okay.
So a lot of times the air seeder's already got 15, 1800 acres of the beans in by the time we get the corn done. Then my son switches that one over and then he goes and helps finish planting the beans.
So basically with your no-till, are you straight 50-50 on your rotation then?
Pretty much. I mean, we're a little heavier on corn this year because we thought last fall it mm-hmm. kind of looked like maybe the way to go. So
right.
we fertilized a little heavier on the corn side, but mm-hmm. and we're really 100% no-till, except a few years ago the yields have been so good here on the corn mm-hmm. that we was having trouble dealing with all them stalks in the no-till on the beans. The ground just didn't dry out in the spring.
Oh, I see.
And we kept fighting that. I mean, the ridge tops would be great, but as soon as you went through a little swale, you know, it's damp and it's just not, mm-hmm. I'm not liking how it looks. So
yeah,
I actually bought a high speed disc, I think 3 years ago, and we run it real lightly in the fall over all the corn stalks and kind of let get some black showing, you know, so it will mm-hmm. dry out. And we've gotten along a lot better planting beans that way. So,
oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. Kind of modified, almost minimal, you know.
Right.
And that's right. You see so many different things, you know, throughout Iowa, you know, and really it can vary so much about every 100 miles. Mm-hmm. You know, it seems like a certain township gets hip to something and then, you know, a lot of people in the neighborhood are doing it. But have you seen a lot of guys try to get into 20 and 15 inch rows for corn?
Yeah. There's actually quite a few of them around me. Mm-hmm. And you visit with them about it and they're not real, I don't know. They kind of, most of them wish they wouldn't have did it, just to be honest with you.
Yeah.
They really don't see a huge advantage in it, I guess.
Mm-hmm. There'd have to be a big advantage to pay for the extra combine parts and row units and snouts, you know, like if you're running a lot more machinery over the same space.
Yes. And that's their point exactly. And for what they spent to get to there, mm-hmm. they're like, we're not seeing what we thought we might have seen with that.
And see, that's the Iowa perspective. In Nebraska, once you make that upgrade and you make a change, it's the best thing you ever did because you got to keep lying to yourself and making sure the money you spent was the best thing. And, you know, surprisingly enough, in my neck of the woods, there's still a lot of guys on what we still call wide rows.
Really?
You know, being 36-inch rows.
Really?
And it might have been a lot of just the way we irrigate and different things like that. But, you know, really a lot of the machine is very similar on planters that you'll see in cotton country. So I think maybe that was a little bit of the back and forth there too. You know, but it's, in my opinion, our corn hasn't gotten any better from 36-inch rows down to 30s. We just made the switch maybe in 21. And I think, again, you got to justify spending your dad's money, you know, and just, you got to let everybody know how great of a move it was. But
right.
You know, our last year on Wide Rose, we just for fun on one quarter, it was through kind of a splitter type planter. We did 15-inch beans on a quarter, and then we did some 36-inch row beans on like 300 acres. And I'm telling you, it was the same yields.
Right.
The only difference was is those narrow beans were a lot easier to cut.
Right.
You know, we probably saved a few thousand bucks on fuel just going right through them. It's like they propped each other up. And so
I'd agree with you 100% on that, on the bean deal, because we've gotten caught before, and I've had to plant some 30 inch rows with my planter too, all three of them. And cause the drill's a 15 too.
Okay. And,
you know, it's very slight difference in anything at all, other than, like you said, the narrow rows are a lot easier to combine.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the only thing I witnessed. I wasn't even running the combine. I'm just, you know, running the grain cart, or what we say in Nebraska, the auger wagon.
Right.
And, was running the wagon. So.
The auger wagon.
Yeah. That's what we call it, man. I don't know if anybody else does that.
That's what we do over there too. So.
Okay. Yeah,
I got a kid that's ran the auger wagon for me for 15 years, and he can run a million. And we run every bushel through that because we run two 12 row machines in corn too, and we usually run right together, and we only have the one cart we run. So trying to keep him down on how far he's got to run back and forth, you know, and he hauls every bushel, and I make the laugh that in that million and a half bushel through that thing, whatever he runs through it, it's like, he doesn't spill a coffee can either. And he can unload one of those. He can unload a load to them semis in like 90 seconds. It's like, if it's a good thing you guys don't rely on me to run that thing, because we'd have a lot of scoop shovel messes.
Oh, that's so easy to do. And then honestly, I think it's the hardest job on the farm, especially when you're running, you know, and it's everybody picks on the grain cart, man. And, you know, I mean, really, that's the toughest job, going back and forth in a combine.
Yeah,
that's why it beeps when you get to the headland, you know, so you don't run over the road. But so what, I think we're doing an endorsement here. So what type of auger wagon are you guys running?
We've got a Brent Avalanche. It's a 1600 bushel one.
I was going to say it had to be up there. Yeah, because that's...
We've been talking about going to the 2300 or something. But we got tracks on the deer tractor, and then obviously tracks on the cart, so he can just haul across the field, you know, when he's empty and smooth and go like heck, and which makes a difference. So
yeah, it really does. And and I don't know this, but I'm hoping it does, because you know, I started off with no suspension, and we've been running the same wagon for 20 years, an 875 J&M, and it does the trick, you know. But
what I started out with.
Oh yeah, no, it's not a bad thing. You still see a lot of those in my neck of the woods, but yeah, I mean, there's so many different ways to play the game, you know. And it's something that always scared me is, you know, my grandpa always said that, you know, sometimes a guy playing the minimum at the table, playing one hand, will stick around the table longer. You know, and I think you see that in ag, and, you know, some guys, they don't scale at a reason that makes sense. But what's interesting about your story is you were able to be a little bit more strategic, you know, and I think just the scale of your operation to begin with, you know, there's very few people in my neck of the woods that were farming, you know, 2000 acres in the 90s. And I think it's easier to do for an operation like yourself with all this technology. Right. You know, to basically triple, you know, what you've done, and maybe a little bit more. So it's a little bit more of a comfort zone. I think a lot of folks, it's so hard to prepare for the next step. And it's a tough decision to make. And if you don't have enough help, and that's just a common theme to every producer I talk to all over the country. And it's just, well, God, I got to get an automatic day cab because I can't get anybody to shift to 10 speed, you know, and it's just, and not saying I'm good at shifting 10 speed either. I'm just saying that, you know, it's hard to get people in there and help you out when you need it most. But, you know, at this current level, and you don't have to answer any of these questions. We're not with the IRS, but, you know, as far as your operation, is there kind of a golden ratio of owned land to rented, or does that factor in any of your decisions?
You know, I would like to be 50%, I guess. mm-hmm. owned to rent it. I don't know if we'll get there, but the way things, this land, it just, even in our area, there's been some, I mean, that one was a 95 CSR. I don't know. Iowa.
That's about as good as it gets. Yeah.
Right, it goes by CSR. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. And it had a couple of windmills on it, but, it just, you know, even now at today's commodity prices, it's just, it's tough to pencil that out. So, I don't know. I'd hope to be there, but I don't know if I'll quite get there.
Well, you know, the easiest thing to ask a farmer, the worst thing I hate when people from Texas or something, well, how many acres you farm?
Right.
Who cares? You know, but the question that I love to ask is, how bad are your property taxes per acre?
Ours are not too bad. Accordingly, mm-hmm. I'm going to say probably going to average around $35.
Okay. Yeah. And it's, I think Nebraska was just early to the party with the high property taxes. And surprisingly, you know, now the schools are built, you know, and it really seems like we've really stayed relatively flat, thankfully. But, you know, we were anywhere between 55 and 75, you know, 15 years ago.
Wow.
And we've maintained. And there was a farm today, somebody I know was bidding on, and it was around $50 an acre, you know, and it just doesn't seem too bad. But when I first started going to Dallas County, Iowa, you know, God, it was like $18 to $24.
Yeah.
You know, now I talk to those guys and similar to your neck of the woods, about 30 to 40 is pretty common.
Yep.
And I used to say Nebraska was the tax me state, but, you know, really we're going to have to give that title to Illinois because a lot of my buddies that farm over there are just, you know, holy cow.
Right.
You know, but they're getting 18,000 an acre, pretty common. And I still don't understand. I mean, my calculator does the same math that yours does. And, you know, $3 corn, I just don't understand this game anymore.
I know. You know? And, it's tough. I'm like you. They have a different pencil than I have, I guess. So
yeah, apparently. And I don't know what the right move is, you know? And so,
well, if you think about the number one rule of money is to not lose money. I think your chances of losing money in agriculture is pretty low. I mean, think about, even if you would have paid $3,000 an acre,
right.
Give it some time and you mm-hmm. won't lose money. Right. And I think that's most producers that have cash flow, like they're not going to invest in crypto. They're not going to go try and trade the stock market because they're going to lose their money. They'd mm-hmm. rather lose it doing something they enjoy doing.
Right.
Or at least buried in the ground. I mean, that's mm-hmm. it's still better than a savings account.
Right.
You know, even at 1% interest, you're still beating the crap out of a savings account in most times. I mean, today I think it's a little bit better. But I think that's why you see the farmland prices not really correcting during this time. The interest rates, and then the fact that what else are we gonna do? Because everything, you know, it's hard to find good deals out there.
Yep. Yep. And it's like I said earlier, it doesn't matter when you buy the ground. It always seems like it's too high at the time. So, it's.
But surely it had to pencil better, you know, at some point, you know, over time. But I mean, the yields and everything differ a lot, you know. And I know my dad graduated high school in 73. He was 17 years old, you know, and then that summer, 340 to 350 range on corn.
Right.
And, you know, and then if you look at that versus inflation, it'd be a gazillion dollars, you know, a bushel, you know, but, you know, our yields were a little bit higher in Nebraska.
Right.
And it's not just because of our better corn, you know, but in all reality, it's just things were different because of irrigation.
Right.
And I think the areas that have benefited for me, again, this is not genetic advice, but the things that have benefited, you know, the corn production has been some of these dry land areas where, you know, in Iowa, generally speaking, you guys usually don't have a drought out year. But, you know, when you are a little bit weather restricted or on the moisture side, it does seem like some of these newer genetics and hybrids perform better to drought stress.
Right. They've really came along again in the last, well, every year it seems like, but yeah, it's pretty amazing what they'll do, yield wise. Cause I think the last two or three years, our average has been in the 225 to 245 range. Mm-hmm. In fact, I've had a couple of farms in the last couple of years, 160s, mm-hmm. Made 301.
Jeez.
On dry land.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, the hybrids, like I say, the technology and the planting equipment, I mean, everything is just so precise. Every plant is perfect. The depth is perfect. It's just all that stuff makes a difference. So
yeah, it does. And I guess for your guys' pH, how do your soybeans fare?
You know, I don't feel like the soybeans have came up quite as much maybe as the corn. Mm-hmm. We did have a 70 bushel average this year on beans, which I'm going to say is probably close to the best we've ever had.
Okay.
You know, I can remember not all that many years ago, if you had a 50 straight through in our area, you felt pretty good about it. So
right.
I just don't feel like they've quite had the jump in yield that maybe the corn has.
Yeah. And it's just, it's fun for me to learn and watch because we've done so many years of corn on corn, you know, and in our area, you can get away with it because of the irrigation and, you know, there's a lot of livestock action. There's reasons why you can do that in my part of Nebraska, but then you do switch to those bean years and holy cow, you know, it's just, you want to tell everybody about your upgrades and then you're about your yields next. And, you know, and for us, unfortunately anymore, you know, it might be the county average is 70, but that's, you know, being drugged down in sub areas.
Right.
And beans are so finicky. When I learned these things firsthand, you never forget them. And, you know, you get a hailstorm and then your final stand counts are under 80,000.
Right.
And you still make 70 bushel.
Right.
You know, and it's really an interesting crop that I don't think a lot of folks quite understand yet.
No.
And I could call Harry Stein and if he'd pick up the phone, he'd probably tell me the same thing. Nobody knows.
Right.
You know, and it's the magic of the bean. So,
no, but I think there's a lot to learn on those yet, really. We've tried all the we have been backing our population off quite a bit. Mm-hmm. I mean, we used to be 200,000, just plain and simple, blow 200,000 out there and forget it, you know. And I mean, I think we're down to about 130 now. And we've tried the 80s and 90s stuff on a few acres. But like you say, if you happen to have a weather event that get a hard rain or something and they come up tough and then you got 50,000 out there and then it's like, do I go spot some in, you know, what do you do? And so I don't know, we just haven't been able to make that work yet. I guess
we had that happen last year where we had to replant like 3/4 of our beans because we had a huge cold rain event. Like weather, it was dry, perfect, and then we had like a week of just 40 and 30 degree rains.
Yeah.
Inches of rains on the beans in the ground. And they just smoked them. So we had to replant just about everything.
That's tough on them. You can't make that work. Yeah. They just won't come out of it. So,
well, and then you're seeing guys are, you know, keeping their bean kit in and that's the first crop they plant now in Nebraska. And, you know, even some of the guys I know in central and, you know, east central Iowa, that's more of the theme anymore. And it just makes me nervous because I don't necessarily care when I put something in the ground. I'm thinking, how am I going to get that out of there?
Right.
That's my biggest concern with doing the bean game early.
Right.
And then this weather, you know, usually in Nebraska, the past 12, 13 years I've been farming, it can be so wild. It's like the Mother Nature's just trying to tease you into the field. Legal date's the 9th, you know, and then it's just beautiful. It's 80s and amazing. Then you get to about the 20th or so, and it's barely above freezing.
Right.
You know? And so I've had some, you know, phenomenal yields with some corn that was put in the ground May 5th.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
I don't know if it really, some people just overthink it, but, you know, for your operation, you know, covering that many acres, there's probably a lot more thought that goes into it.
We just pretty much got to be rolling by, like I said, the 8th to the 10th, somewhere in there, we try to get going and at least get a good start on it. But I mean, 224 rows, if we have 3 good days, I mean, we can plant easily. We've planted 700 acres in a day with the two machines. So we can mow right through it. If it's, I mean, there's times also we've done so much that I've said, you know, we need to put the brakes on here a little bit. Maybe we got a weather event coming in a week. Let's just slow down a little bit too. So yeah, we kind of we put some thought into it and look at the weather forecast type situation.
So are you brand loyal or what are you running with machinery?
Pretty much 100% John Deere. Yeah. We run a couple of 780 combines. That's another whole deal. I'm going to run, these will be the third year with these. It's been probably 20 years since I've ran a machine 3 years in a row, but I can't get together on a trade deal to make anything work. No.
Yeah. Well, you got to pay attention to our next auction. We'll have a few things on there. Maybe you can get into, but, and that's the hard part. You know, it's just, there's this really interesting dynamic in machinery where the dealers are afraid of the large publisher. The farmers are afraid of their dealer. And nobody wants to go against anybody.
Yep.
And it's, you know, and it's weird. If I buy a Buick in Mississippi and I take it to my local GM dealer, they high five me and, oh, it's a sharp Buick and, you know, everything's great on the oil change. But if I buy an 8R in Mississippi and I bring it to my local John Deere dealer, you know, I basically get cussed out and thrown to the back of the line.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that I, from a manufacturing level, you know, it's the territories are real. And those service areas mean a lot to them. And again, you know, the larger operators have to at least be aware of this because, you know, what happens when you break down, you know, and with all the sensors and all the technology, you basically have to keep your dealership happy.
You do.
You have to buy the service manager and do it yourself.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. And that's a good way to, and honestly, a lot of guys, you know, their first hired man they get, you know, as a diesel mechanic that has that experience that went through, you know, all the different channels of their dealership. And next thing you know, they're working at their shop because, it's a tricky deal with this technology and all the things. So now are your planters, are you running Xactimerge then?
Yep. They're two Xactimerges.
Yeah.
High speeds?
Yeah, they're high speeds. Yep. And what's crazy about those silly things too, which you guys have probably had that experience too, but it seems like when you get over, you run 8 or 9 mile an hour with them, they'll run 99%. You run them, run them up to 10 and 11, they'll do 99.9, and they'll run good enough that the little hoppers won't keep up with the.
You're right. There you go.
The seat on demand. So, yeah.
Yeah. So no, they. I say those things have helped immensely on corn yields too. It's crazy.
You know, before the Xactimerge, did you ever run precision planting?
Yep, I had precision. Yep. It worked great too. I had no trouble with it. It's a typical deal. It was probably just easier to get it through Deere at the time and it was all right there. And that's why I went with the Xactimerge. So
now with the planting into bean stubble, do you just run right on top and split them evenly, or do you nudge like 8 or 9 inches, or what's your technique with no-till planting?
We've got the John Deere trash whippers on the front that are they don't touch the ground, but you know, if there's anything there and you're going that fast, it'll pick it up and toss it around.
Okay.
Move it over just a little bit. So I don't like to run them very deep at all, just because I don't like to furrow open the soil and, you know, make big trenches type deal, but just enough to kind of move the stubble.
Okay. So, I wasn't sure if you went in at angles or how that worked.
No, we usually run, we'll try to offset the rows from last year, but kind of run in the middle of them. But you know, we got a lot of contour stuff where I'm at. So a lot of times that doesn't work either. So
let it rip.
Todd, how do you make your grain marketing decisions? Because I mean, obviously to grow like you've grown and farm as long as you've farmed, you must have done fairly well.
I think I have three services I belong to at the time right now, you know, and listen to all those guys. I probably did a better job of marketing though before I had this, we got this grain complex put up, because I think before that, when I was so short on storage with all those acres, I had everything done way ahead of time and kind of knew where stuff was going. The grain setup has made me somewhat lazy, and I've had to get back on top of that a little better. I've always tried to follow it pretty close. My son follows it really close now too, And he probably keeps up on it better than I do, but yeah.
How have you transitioned the management decisions and operational activities between your son and your son-in-law down the next generation?
Well, they make it so I can be down here by your dad all winter long. and they've done a good job. Both of them are really intelligent. They're real techy. My son-in-law actually has a seed chemical and fertilizer business that he runs kind of out there out of our deal. And I was kind of telling you about the top dress stuff and some of that. They're really good at getting on top of that stuff and learning where we need to be and checking on fertilizer prices and seed cost and things like that. So I can be gone and don't have to deal with that, I guess. So yeah, they've done a good job.
Are you doing all the marketing yourself or is your son involved? And then what about equipment decisions?
It's kind of a mutual deal. We both do together because we both commingle everything into the setup there. Yeah. Him and I. And so it's kind of a decision we both make together. We both know where our break evens are all the time. And you know, right now there's not a lot left there on the bone, but
what do you use to calculate your break even? You throwing things in a spreadsheet or?
Yeah. Yep. Yep. And all the machinery, everything's in there. And we have, it's all figured kind of down to the penny. So, and we've kind of started doing it farm by farm too now, getting a little more into that. So we're still transitioning to that, I guess, but we've done that some. So,
well, and outside of the equipment updates, you know, I know that, I sympathize in the grain storage because it can make you a lot of money and it can lose, you know, just as much or more as well. And it's a lot of work. You know, it doesn't matter if you got a power sweep or you've got three kids with shovels, you know, it's somebody's got to get in there. And I think that's the hardest part with grain storage. But what would you say has been the biggest blessing to your operation? You know, has it been machinery with technology? Has it been more so on the chemical and nutrient side, or, you know, maybe more so these marketing offerings with different analysis there?
You know, kind of all of the above, I would have to say, really there. I mean, there's a portion of every one of those that have helped out immensely. I don't know if one's any more than the other. I want to say the technology part of it has probably helped out the most because it seems like really the rates we put on as far as fertilizers, chemicals, and things like that really hasn't changed a lot over the 40 about years I've been doing this. Mm-hmm. But the technology's probably helped the most. And having young guys involved like Scott there and yourself that have, you know, have some new ideas and things, it definitely makes a difference. I mean, they're always looking and reading and studying and they've came up with some great ideas that I'm like, and what's good, I guess, since I've done so many of that, I've done a lot of that stuff too over the years. If they come to me with something and I say, well, I tried that 15 years ago, I don't think we need to waste our time on that. And kind of bounce them off each other, I guess. So,
yeah. Now, was the disease very prevalent in your part of Iowa with the southern rust and the tar
spot? Yeah, it was pretty strong. We had two farms we didn't fungicide. Mm. And because there were some trees around them, they were next to a river bottom and just hard to get them covered. They weren't big farms, but they were 100 bushel off.
Yeah.
And that was just right to the money.
Yeah, and it was kind of an eye-opener. I went out to Farm Progress and, you know, kind of started off at St. Joe, let's say, in Missouri, and then went east. And thought, well, God, I didn't know they had a drought. You know, well, no. And then every now and again, there'd be a random 80 or a quarter that's just lush green and beautiful.
Right.
And they probably had a double dose of the good stuff. And, you know, and that's – do you play any sort of fungicide games with soybeans?
Yep, we always fungicide the beans. We use our ground rigs to do it.
Okay.
It, we think it's paid over the years. This year, we don't think we've seen much out of it per se, but we've probably been doing that close to 10 years now. Yeah. And in general, we go with the cheaper stuff on the soybeans because we haven't seen a lot of difference in the higher price stuff versus the cheap stuff, I guess, in our operation. But I mean, there's be guys out there that probably argue that fact easily, but that's been our case.
Yeah. And in my neck of the woods now, white mold becoming, a little bit more of a concern in certain areas and on their radar. And, really a lot of the guys that switch down and we're doing out of a splitter, they're more so to go back to 30s on their beans again because of it.
Get some more air through there and
try
things out a little more. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think the golden window is for applying fungicide on beans?
I kind of leave that up to my son and son-in-law, but I'm not sure where we usually start on that. They kind of, like I said, they do make the call on that kind of stuff, and I usually just run the spray truck.
Yeah, well, somebody's got to run the wagon back and forth, but it's just, for us, a lot of it's just more so, do we need insecticide? And if we do, and if we got an aerial apply, then, every now and again, we might dabble in that. But yeah, mostly a generic and, really kind of right around the same time the corn's a tassel.
Same way. We generally throw a little bit of insecticide in every time too, just the generic stuff. And
yeah,
since we're making the trip over it, we do it. And yeah.
So. Now you're on that side of the Missouri River. Is it all enlist beans or are you guys still open to extend flex?
There's still a little bit of everything, but generally enlist. I mean, I think everybody's about switched to enlist at this point. So,
we're pretty extend flex heavy over on this side.
Really,
and it's interesting when you get into Iowa. Just that switch is pretty evident, and I've got my own suspicions why, but. is there anything that you've preferred over the years on soybeans or even as far as maturity and maturity groups?
We generally run a little bit higher maturity just because and we've gotten bit by it, but I've always, because we do sometimes get dry in August, we've always felt like if we was in the 3.4 to 3.8 range on beans, maybe gave them a little bit of a chance for that late August rain if we did get something to bump them a little bit. Now, actually, this past year, we had ample rain all year, so the 3.0s and 3.1s were probably better than any of the full season ones. So, just make sure you have a little bit of everything, in my opinion, because that's I've had it go both ways.
Okay.
Another question on the marketing thing. Are you doing futures and options, or have you ever done futures and options?
Yeah, I have, still do some. I'm not gonna make out that I'm ever 100% right on any of that stuff, but yes, I do both. And sometimes good, sometimes bad. Just that's how it is.
So with the advisors that you hire, do you give them the money and then they make the trades for you?
Yep, typically.
I see.
Yep.
And so are you also doing strategies with your soybeans where you'll sell, like there's a Minnesota co-op that a lot of our local guys sell to the crusher through, and then they store their beans and they sell through the Minnesota because the patronage is like $1 a bushel extra. So do you do things like that, or what's kind of a way to pick up a few pennies here and there?
I've done that in the past when they've had, Gavilon, it was close to us, and they used to have some programs like that, but they've sold out near us now. And so the past few years, we haven't really had any of those options, I guess, that on the soybeans to try. So So no, I haven't been, it's probably been 5 years since we've done anything like that.
Sure. So I'm just curious, farming is probably the most capital intensive business other than mining or something like that.
Yeah.
And I'm curious if you have like some good strategies, especially at the beginning, on how you were able to cash flow your way through and manage the taxes at the same time, because the cash flow situation bleeds into the tax conversation too, because we just get nothing other than machinery, nothing depreciates for us.
Right. Right.
So just curious about that.
You know, it's just, it seems like over the years I've been able to make the, I've kind of tried to keep the machinery at a level that, I can still use it, I guess, if need be, but it's like walking a tightrope, really, you know. I mean, it's, you can't get too overly done on the equipment side of it that you're having trouble getting it all used, and yet running yourself out of cash, you know, trading for that stuff. So it's just I've kind of tried to walk a tightrope on that most of my times. Some of my tax guys have been like, wow, you're about the only guy I've ever seen do the things that you do. And it looks like it works. But other than just walking a tightrope, that's pretty much what I've done.
What do you mean by it? Can you elaborate on that? The only guy that does the things that you do?
Well, some of the numbers he's used on depreciation over the years, he's like, holy cow, you know. So we've been able to make it work, but you can't, I guess what I'm saying, you can't have everything on the farm brand new and try to have a $2 million depreciation type situation and ever make it all cash flow. It's not going to work. No. So by walking that tightrope, I mean, you're on the side of using quite a bit of that stuff for depreciation to stop the tax man, and it's, you know, it's a fine line.
And I like to call it a delicate dance, you know, because it really is. And I've got big feet, and I just don't want to step on too many toes. And I think that's the biggest problem. And I love it and I hate it with agriculture. Hey. And for me, it's just, you have to be able to do so many things so well,
right?
You know, and it used to be more so of a diverse operation. You'd have to, you know, be able to play some hay games and livestock and row crop. You know, now it's just, you have to focus on what you're good at, but then you have to know every single intricate, you know, play.
Right.
And I think that's the hardest thing for me to really wrap my head around. And I guess that's why the young kids want communism, because they just want to put seeds in the dirt, you know, and just a one track mind. And, you know, and I guess, you know, we'll see what happens if the state ever gets that much control. But, you know, that's the hard part. It's just, you can fall in love with running machinery,
right,
but, you know, even the same way when it comes to business, you can be terrible at running an operation or being a manager.
Right.
Yeah,
that's you're exactly right. I mean, that's it in a nutshell, really. So
we'll make sure to clip that.
What about the cash flow? You know, like, man, it can be tough trying to come up with the money that you need to run the operation, pay the employees, and then, you know, you get paid a year later to recover.
Well, especially in a year like this where we've had, you know, somewhat depressed prices. They aren't horrid, but coming off what we have came off of the past 2 or 3 years, I've noticed the bends seem to be going down a little faster this year than they did the past 2 or 3 years. So I mean, that's the same thing too. And it's like, you kind of want to try and capture some of that cash in the market, hopefully, for a bump somewhere down the line. So you just try to get by with what you can as far as cash flow on short-term stuff, and try to hang on and give yourself another chance. And trying the futures and options thing a little bit and playing some of those games.
Are you doing commodity loans on what you got in the bin for cash flow? Like, I do that a lot. If I fill the bins, I'll immediately take a commodity loan, get some cash.
I did that for years, and I'm finally, I've got far enough along that I haven't had to do that for probably 5 or 6 years now. But yeah, I mean, that's a great way of doing it. And you know, there's a lot of people out there that I don't think use that to their advantage, that really it's a great thing. So yeah, I have, and that's good.
What in your mind, when you were starting out, or like your son, for example, who's kind of in the transition phase to at the beginning farmer, well, he's been here for 15 years, so he's beyond beginning farmer. But when it comes to debt, what's your comfort level for debt for somebody like your son and then yourself? My dad's like hates debt, right? He doesn't want even zero debt. But what's your, like, let's talk about debt for a moment there. Especially for young guys, because we have there's a lot of young guys trying to get in farming.
Well,
that's a challenge.
My son's probably a little more frugal than I am, I guess. So he thinks sometimes I probably overspend on equipment and stuff, I guess. But it's like I've told him, it's like, okay, if you're going to try to farm this amount of acres, you can't do it with a 15-year-old machine. And you really need to, you know, put the pencil to it and see if that will work. And just, again, try to have a balancing act on what works and what cash flows and what it's going to take. And he's done really good. Obviously, for me, I still have to borrow some money, but it's not what I used to. It's never bothered me because I borrowed money my whole life to get started. When we started from, mm-hmm. I mean, like I said, I told you in the beginning, from scratch, I've borrowed money from day one. So it's never bothered me because it's got me where I'm at. And I've used my wife always says our EBITDA looks great, you know, so, and that's what everybody looks at. Yeah. So, and my son, he hasn't had to borrow as much just because, I guess of the help that Deb and I have gave him kind of getting started. So I kind of chuckle sometimes that I said, you got way more net worth than I had at your age already, you know? So yeah.
Same for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I don't know. It's just, it's a very hard business. And I think even harder than all of that is just managing all of, you know, these interesting points.
Different aspects, yeah.
It's hard to grasp, and it's unfortunate. And I think, you know, our next guest that we have on is more so on the homeschooling side. And I think it'll be interesting to see, you know, their thoughts on accounting and everything else. Even when I was a kid, you know, and we won't talk about how far back this was, but, you know, we had basically somewhat of a class you had to do, and one thing you would do is you'd balance a checkbook. Mm-hmm. And it blows my mind how many, you know, young farmers I know that's not even a thought. You just write the check, and then it comes from the operating, they fulfill, and you know, an actual working balance. I mean, holy cow, what does that even mean?
Right.
And, you know, and we're kind of at the hour mark here. Todd, if you want to, you know, maybe wrap this up a little bit. I know we were all over the place, and I think there's going to be a lot of farmers that watch this, and especially young farmers, you know, kind of our demographics all over the place. And we've dove into it a little bit, but there is a decent chunk or segment that there's going to be some producers there that they're at kind of a you know, a split in the road here. And right. And you've seen this in the 80s. I feel like we're repeating history to some degree. You know, it doesn't always repeat, but they say it rhymes, or there's a lot of similarities. You know, where we are right now, it's 2026. Number one, congratulations to making it this far in the game. But, you know, what's going to happen next as far as your operation, or if there's another younger farmer out there that's, you know, in the game a little bit, you know, I guess what's your advice?
Well, they you know, watch the numbers. You got to have, like I said, if you're, whatever you're doing, the equipment's got to be good enough that because I mean, we're on such a time frame on what we do every day that you gotta make sure things run and with limited amounts of problems. And I've always had that theory since I've started and had pretty good stuff all along. I mean, that's one of the big things, I guess. And, but yet don't overextend yourself so far that you got to keep the equipment cost per acre in line and not get ridiculous. It's just, I've seen so many guys over the years start out and go for a year or two and just everything brand new. And then boom, things just go south and they're gone.
Yeah.
So, you know, you kind of got to work into that stuff slow and not, like I said, there was a couple times there when I doubled my acreage, I was sweating a few times just because that was a pretty big jump at that age with the stuff I had. So, you know, I don't think that's good to do that. I think you need to kind of do it in increments. Yeah. I realize the timing of all this stuff, you may never get another chance. So that all comes into play too. And you kind of got to decide where that is and go from there. So,
yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting time because I meet with older farmers, you know, semi frequently, and I met with a heck of a producer yesterday, kind of an older customer of mine. And, you know, he's got back problems. He's in great shape. He's a lean little guy, you know, but it's just the reality is he's got nobody to take over. Wow. And he's like, Zach, I'd like to, you know, rent some of this out. And in his backyard last week, a half section brought 12,900 an acre. Wow. You know, and his access to cash would be huge right now. I mean, I think his ground would drive a commanding price, but, you know, we're all kind of married to this ground. And so, you know, he's going to struggle through it this season, probably needing a back surgery, a major one, you know, but he's like you guys, he's got all those fancy Signature Series cabs and he's dialing in his massage seats. I know how those green paint guys run, you know, so they can get through it another year with pain, but it's just, that's the hardest part. There are opportunities in agriculture.
Right.
And I think what I would like to, you know, maybe convey to the younger audience is look at our ancestors.
Right.
You know, mine stopped in Chicago for a few years. Then they made the final, you know, voyage into this most beautiful part of the world is known as Adams County, Nebraska. And they stopped here and they put their feet down. But it doesn't mean that you have to necessarily be married to your backyard. Right. You know, and there's opportunities out there. If you want to be a producer, I think how bad do you really want it? You know, and what type of sacrifice do you want to make if you really want to be involved in this industry? Because there's guys just like that gentleman I'm talking about yesterday that are in every single county that would probably give you an opportunity.
Right.
And I think you just need to communicate. And I think that's a lot of it. Don't be afraid to communicate. But if you were really, you know, back up against the wall, would you expand your operation right now or would you dial things back?
Oh, boy. I guess, yeah, I wouldn't have a problem maybe stretching out a little bit farther. But there again, not right now. I would not get crazy about that. I'd go baby steps.
Okay. And, you know, and not being a professional marketer here or gambler, or maybe we're all combinations of this. But, you know, is this insurable price coming here in the next month or so? Is that a major point to focus on as far as what you're going to hedge and how you're going to market your commodities?
You know, it's a small piece of it, I guess, but the problem of it is for most of us, we made those decisions last fall, basically what we were going to do for the spring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Unless things really, you know, change, but for the most part, I think most guys are that way. I mean, they made the decision for fertilizer, nitrogen last fall, and it's already on and they're going to go with what they'd kind of decided.
Okay.
That'd be my guess. I mean, most of the guys in my area I know are that way. So
yeah. Probably anhydrous heavy then in your neck of the woods, or guys gassing pretty tough still?
Pretty hard, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Scott, what are your thoughts here on today's episode?
Did we have any comments from the live stream?
I didn't see any that came through. We had a problem streaming on Facebook and about half our questions come there. There was a few kind of unrelated comments that came up, but, you know, nothing in particular, I guess you could say.
Okay. No, it's just great to get a perspective from, you know, another farmer, especially one that's been around through the 80s, you know, and we just appreciate having you on, Todd. I mean, it's great to hear your experience and what worked for you and you know, it's great to see that you've got your son and your son-in-law involved, which I think a lot of farmers, that's why I'm having so many kids. I don't know who's going to do it.
Well, that's your problem. You're not farming in Adams County with all this opportunity and these high rises behind me. So, you know, I think it's easy to farm where I'm at because, you know, we're around this thriving metropolis back here of 25,000 people, but it's just, you know, and a lot of folks, and I say that almost half honestly, because, you know, think about the guys in Western Nebraska where, right. you know, they've got maybe 80 people, you know, right. at the county seat, you know, and that's
right.
it.
Right.
And it is hard, and there's a lot of good acres out in those fringe areas.
Yeah. Right.
You know, and it is difficult to, you know, stay a little bit rural when, if you can't get Walmart delivery or Amazon same day, I mean, or even in society. And I think that's another dynamic in agriculture. It'd be interesting, you know, and Todd,
Amazon Prime is 5 days for me.
Okay. Well, see, you're in those fringe areas.
We're in the boonies.
Well, that's why you got to go to the desert in the winter. You know, I mean,
right.
you just got to offer the cows to guys like me.
Keep my wife sane because she goes to the farm.
Well, it's difficult, you know, and every operation is different.
It's hard to get to raise a family out there. You know, like the wife is bored out of her mind. We're 40 minutes from civilization, really.
Right.
You know,
We're basically an hour or two from anywhere. Des Moines an hour, Omaha's an hour, so.
Yeah.
We get it. We're kind of in the same area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's, I don't know, every operator's got a different perspective, but I will say, you know, we've had a lot of really cool guests on the show. I mean, people that some would consider famous, you name it, but you know, honestly, Todd, it's been really enjoyable talking with you because, you know, your operation, it stood, you know, really recent history. And I think there was somewhat of a great reset, if you will, in agriculture when you got into the mid-80s. And, you know, you witnessed that from your dad's operation into what you created. And, you know, honestly, hats off to everything that you've done because, you know, you see that in my area, too. There's a couple of families that they took the 80s by the horns and they really cut their teeth there and they made it. And it really propelled them through the 90s and, you know, all the good times that we've had off and on over the years. You know, started because of what you did in the 80s and your hard work. So, congratulations for all you've done and everything in your family. And, you know, if you ever want to hop on and just tell me what you booked fertilizer for, let me know. I really enjoy the talks with farmers because, you know, there's so many people out there that, you know, you're in the middle of nowhere. You know, you're on your own little island and not everybody's clicking a mouse and on the internet the same way that we are. And not that I even want to be that, but I do think, you know, we could all learn from each other and learn what other guys are doing. And it's nothing personal. We're not going to try to rent your ground if you come on our show. You know, it's not as cutthroat when you're a state away, at least.
It's
a great place, Todd. And I again, thank you for your time and reach out anytime. I'd love to meet up with you in person at some point. And if you ever make it to any Anderson family functions up north there, just keep me posted. We'll try to make that happen. But again, everybody out there paying attention, you know, I appreciate all the comments, all the support and all the reviews and the restreams of our show. If anybody has any questions or ideas on guests, feel free to leave those comments below. But for Scott Anderson, New Age Ag Supply, he's got some amazing inventory available right now. If you need to make an upgrade, that's a great place to look. Another great place to look is Tractor Tuesday. We've got two huge auctions, February 17th and 24th. You can still get on the February 24th auction. Again, there's zero commission. Yeah, we do a 5% buyer's premium, but we cap it at $7,500. It's transparent. You know what you're getting into at Tractor Tuesday. But for all the great guests and everyone here on the panel today, I'm Zach Bosley signing off. TractorTuesday.com.